Welcome to the New Thinking for a New World podcast, the Telberg Foundation's exploration of the great issues that are challenging and changing our societies, for better and for worse. I suspect you agree with us that the global outlook is worrisome, to put it mildly. It will take great leaders to bend the arc of history in a more positive direction. And you can help us find, celebrate, and nurture leaders who will make a difference. Nominate someone for the Telberg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize before May 15th. Just go to telbergprize.org, but go there now. Meanwhile, enjoy this week's conversation. Almost 7 months ago, Hamas terrorists stormed into Israel, raping, murdering, and kidnapping. In response, Israel launched its attack on Gaza that has reportedly killed at least 34,000 people, leveled much of the Gaza Strip, significantly degraded Hamas's military capacity, and killed a number of senior political and military commanders and officers. But the war continues and, no surprise, has spread to include, in various combinations, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. What is surprising is that it hasn't spread further. It's probably too early to derive lessons, but given the potential that this war could further metastasize, it's not too early to at least try. To do that, I've invited Armin Rosen, a U.S.-based journalist for Tablet, to share his insights about Israel, Hamas, Iran, Hezbollah, America, the region, and of course, the war. Welcome, Armin, to New Thinking for a New World.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
I've read a bunch of your recent articles, and I've got to congratulate you. You are thinking about what comes next, even though obviously nobody knows. But let's start at the beginning. You recently wrote that before this all started, the Israelis had believed that they had reduced Hamas to, quote, strategic insignificance, while the Hamas leader, for his part, Yanuar Sinwar, had convinced himself, again, your words, quote, that the violent destruction of the Zionist entity was close at hand, unquote. How could both have been so completely wrong?
That's a great question. On the Israeli side, there is great comfort in any sort of prosperous democratic society in believing that your biggest problems have been brilliantly solved. I think that the Israelis sort of fell into a delusion that they could resolve a lot of their biggest strategic challenges by not resolving them, right? So under that sort of framework, which has been sort of the dominant view of Israeli life across both the left and the right for the last, I would argue, 15 years or so, you could sort of pay Hamas to get them to not attack you, right? This was actually a very brilliant form of risk management, right? To bring in Qatar in the United States and various other sort of partners, you give them a stake, in making the Gaza Strip a fairly, stable and quasi-normal place. And at the same time, you believe that the rulers of the Gaza Strip want it to be stable and quasi-normal, no matter how radical they are, no matter what they say. And this, over time, this kind of anti-strategy morphs into a strategy, right? Everybody's happy. The economy has been doing extremely well in Israel the last 10 to 15 years. It's easy to sort of shove a lot of potential long-term dangers into the back of your mind. On the Palestinian side, it was very easy to forget before October 7th that Hamas is basically, a messianic utopian political movement, that never abandoned any of its higher principles. And the plan that Yahya Sinwar had on October 7th, it did not succeed in destroying Israel, but, there were sort of conceivable worst case scenarios that Hamas might have gotten fairly close to achieving, right? The original plan for October 7th, as kind of subsequent reporting has uncovered, was that there was to be a West Bank component of the attack, and that the forces from Gaza and the forces from the West Bank would meet somewhere in the middle of the Negev. They would cut Israel in half. At the same time, Hezbollah and the other Iranian proxies would join the war. I would say that there was a real sort of window of danger between October 6th and, say, October 10th or 11th, where I don't think the state's existence was in question necessarily, but where, they could have gotten a much, much further down the road towards some kind of spectacular history shaking result, particularly if Hezbollah had started, you know, let's say if on October 7th, with Israel still reeling Nakba Brigade militants still hiding out from the Israeli military across southern Israel, with the country still no longer in complete control of all of its territory. What if at that moment Hezbollah had decided to launch, you know, some of its precision guided missiles at, like, you know, desalination plants, power plants, major civilian infrastructure inside of Israel? What would that have looked like? So the delusion on Sinwar's part sort of resembles that of, you know, many other, like, religious and, you know, ideological sort of utopians who could kind of squint at reality and see their goals within reach. On the other hand, he got further than arguably anybody else has. And he set the stage for something that could have been far, far worse. Had a few things gone a bit differently that week.
I'll get to the politics of all this in a moment, but let's start, or let's continue with the military issue. Israel is obviously winning, and I put air quotes on the word winning, in any sort of conventional sense of they've clearly disrupted Hamas as a coherent force, body counts, tunnels, other infrastructure destroyed. You know, the list goes on. You're 7 months into this. I'll talk about time in a minute. The 7 months itself is astounding, as you know better than I, but does Hamas still exist as a military force? I don't even know that's the right question. Or can it be reconstituted given what's happened so far?
I actually break with a lot of other observers of this conflict in saying, no, I don't think they can reconstitute. At this point, what has Hamas really done in the last month or so? It's a pretty, you know, it's a question that people don't really ask that often. There have been a few rocket attacks on Ashdod. That's pretty serious. You don't want your major cities being attacked with rockets. There have been a number of red alerts in Sderot. There have been none in Tel Aviv. Tel Aviv has not been, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, there's been no rocket siren in Tel Aviv other than the Iranian ballistic missile attack.
Which we'll get to. We'll get to that in a second.
Hamas has shown no enthusiasm for any frontal confrontation with the Israeli military inside of Gaza itself. The last couple deaths in Gaza were from a friendly fire incident. The last Israeli death in combat in Gaza was well over a week ago. Hamas has notched absolutely no victories on the battlefield whatsoever. Anytime that they have actually tried to fight with the IDF inside of Gaza, you know, this is not like in 2006 where Hezbollah actually was able to stop the IDF in Bint Jabil, and where Israel basically had to consider whether they could achieve their tactical goals in Lebanon. There is no doubt at this point that Israel could achieve its tactical goals in Gaza. It's a matter of kind of the politics and the diplomacy and internal Israeli decision making. It's not a matter of Hamas showing any capacity to stop Israel. Looking towards kind of a post-conflict scenario as well, I cannot imagine any sort of situation in which Hamas will have nearly the operational freedom that it had before October 7th. The cynics who say, you know, well, this is going to, you know, this is just a bigger version of earlier rounds of this war. Things are going to go absolutely back to normal. I just don't see it happening. I don't see Israel facilitating the delivery of billions in cash to the Hamas leadership of Gaza anytime soon. I don't see that border being nearly as poorly defended as it was on October 6th. I don't see Israel declining, you know, to kill major Hamas figures anytime they stick their head above ground, which is something that they, for the most part, did not do the last 15 years under the theory that they needed these people as kind of political and security partners, whether they liked it or not. And Israeli society has changed. There's going to be far less tolerance for anything like a pre-October 7th sort of dispensation, even if the future falls far short of active war.
So let's switch to the northern border then, the border with Lebanon. On the one hand, Israel has been forced to depopulate the borderland, and that is still depopulated today. On the other, Both the Hezbollah attacks and the Israeli responses have been relatively measured. Not that they haven't happened, but it's not been all-out war, as you suggested earlier. That scenario did not develop. But can Israel really accept that, and again, these were, are your words, Hezbollah, quote, now holds the power of life and death within the Jewish state's own territory. That's pretty strong stuff.
Well, the sad reality is that, of course, they can accept it. They can reach some kind of a diplomatic agreement with Hezbollah that keeps Hezbollah's troops on the northern border of Israel, which is something that the United States, frankly, has been pressuring the Israeli government to do for months by now. I mean, in the north, it's really this stark and very kind of difficult choice between kind of accepting that Israel does not control its entire territory and can't defend its own citizens on the one hand, and triggering a very large war that's going to cause massive problems with the United States on the other. The challenge in Lebanon is that, you know, this is something that Tony Bedran, who's an analyst of Gulf Affairs, an analyst of Levant Affairs and Tablets, sort of recently installed news editor, has always noted. Lebanon is kind of an American project the past few years. The U.S. funds the Lebanese military to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a year. There's a new sort of $2 billion embassy in Beirut that serves as a kind of unofficial contact point between Iranian equities and the United States, since Iran has U.S. diplomatic relations. Right. There's kind of a larger American project in Lebanon that that an Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon would very much threaten. One of the major U.S. strategic goals of the war from October 8th onwards was to prevent any kind of major Israeli action in Lebanon. However, you have to eventually make the choice between whether you can defend the entirety of your sovereign territory and whether you want to sustain, you know, whatever the notional benefits of an alliance with the United States are. It's a very tough choice. And then there's the other question of,
let me interrupt just quickly. That's a choice that still lies in the future.
It's a choice that has to be made right now. I don't, if it lies in the future, it doesn't lie very much further in the future, right? I mean, you try to game this out, like, what is the Israeli window for action in Lebanon? It's really the next like 2 months. Anytime past the summer, a war in Lebanon has the potential to really create problems in international commodities markets. It has the potential to drive the price of oil up. Suddenly you're getting into the U.S. election season. Historically, U.S. elections and inaugurations kind of present a bit of a deadline to Israeli military action. I mean, you'll recall that in 2009, Operation Cast Lead, right? It didn't end because Israel was losing the war. It ended because of Barack Obama's inauguration and because of simple fact you don't want to present the new leader of your top ally with a major international crisis as soon as he enters office, right? So in order to act in Lebanon without seeming as if you were driving up oil prices in order to produce a desired result in the U.S. presidential election, you kind of have to do it soon. And you can't do it after the election either. Right. If Biden wins, potentially, you know, he's not going to have a re-election coming up. He can do whatever he wants against Israel. The politics of it no longer matter as much once he wins again. And if Trump wins, you have the artificial deadline of January 20th to end whatever you're doing. And you don't want to get off on the wrong foot with him either. So they have to decide like very, very soon whether there is a way to solve the issues in the north of Israel without producing a massive rupture with the United States. No one has figured that out yet. And it could be that Benjamin Netanyahu, who actually is historically very risk averse, will decide that the wise kind of way out of this is to, you know, open some discussion of the future of the Israeli-Lebanese border in exchange for Hezbollah pretending to withdraw its troops.
Let's segue to Iran. If we were playing a war game a year ago, and we said, well, Israel is going to attack a consulate in Damascus and kill some very important Iranian generals. Iran is going to respond with an absolutely massive, in terms of numbers and weight, if not in terms of targets, drone and missile attack. And then Israel is going to counter respond to that with its own attack, which showed some really fascinating military capacities. I know I would conclude that all hell's about to break loose or has already broken loose, but it didn't. This was a measured tit for tat for tit for tat kind of scenario. What do we conclude from that? Is that good news? Is it bad news? Does it mean that there is a conversation somewhere going on, overtly or covertly, that can contain that potentially really a disastrous relationship?
I mean, my sort of first reaction to the Iranian attack on April 13th was that this was a nightmare scenario that we had been waiting for decades, right? A direct Iranian attack on Israel. Like, wow, right? Right up there with like a Chinese invasion of Taiwan as far as like—
absolutely. Absolutely.
Nightmare scenarios go. And it ended up being relatively lame, right? One serious casualty, a civilian Bedouin, a civilian girl somewhere in the middle of the Negev, no direct hits anywhere, something like a 90% shoot down rate for the Arrow 2, which is highly significant because it hadn't really been field tested before this war. It turns out that Israeli missile defense is extremely good, probably better than the US's missile defense. It's another sort of interesting subplot of this war in the long run, right? You would have thought that this was, again, something that seemed as if it would be like a history shaking disaster ended up being kind of relatively minor. On the other hand, there's nothing minor about launching 120 ballistic missiles at another country, particularly if you're in the process of developing nuclear weapons. In a prior day and age, if a country were attacked by a nuclear threshold state with a ballistic missile, you would have to assume that there were nuclear warheads on some of those missiles, right? Relatively inaccurate. These are weapons that only become accurate if they have something with a very large payload on board. And there have been sort of, again, one of the ignored subplots of this war, are the repeated quasi-nuclear threats that Iranian officials have lobbed at Israel. For instance, the Friday after October 7th, the Iranian foreign minister flew to Damascus and said that if Israel acted against the resistance in Gaza, there would be a, quote, earthquake. And obviously one thing that sets off earthquakes is an underground nuclear detonation, right? So you would have to consider it, even if no one's killed, even if the missiles all miss their targets, right? This is something that has to be taken extraordinarily seriously. The reason it wasn't taken all that seriously is because of the stage management of the United States. The fact that the U.S., instead of kind of choosing who they want to win and lose these sorts of confrontations based on U.S. national interest, has decided that the interest is actually in managing sort of the war between these two countries that are sort of neither adversaries nor allies at the end of the day. I think that's the most significant thing, right? The American preference wasn't towards Israel dealing a blow to Iran. It was towards a larger U.S. managed security order being able to maintain itself. Whether it can do that in the long run is a really kind of interesting question. I think no, but we'll see in 5-10 years.
I want to underline that because I would argue that is a huge shift in fact and in perception from how the U.S. has presented itself and acted for many decades. Now, the question is that unique to this administration, or do you perceive that there is a larger shift going on in how the U.S. is thinking about Israel, the Levant, the neighborhood, the Iranians? After all, it was President Obama who negotiated with the Iranians a deal that President Trump subsequently took apart, et cetera, et cetera. Contextualize.
Yeah, it's not new. And in a way, it's like very Kissingerian in a sense, right? He was able to negotiate sort of a mutually beneficial outcome to the 1973 war, right, on the basis that the U.S. didn't want the Israelis to win by too much. In the end, it was, that was the sort of gambit that managed to flip Egypt over to sort of the pro-Western side, right? It reorganized, the entire security architecture of the Middle East for generations. Very, very successful. Here, I believe that Obama and Biden were aiming for something sort of vaguely similar, right? To show the Iranians that, you know, there could be sort of a better future for the regime under some form of U.S. protection. Interestingly, the Iranians got that protection without having to agree to much of anything. That's the big difference here. Like Sadat actually did sign a peace agreement with Israel. He actually did choose an alliance with the United States over the leadership of the Arab world, right? Egypt actually was kicked out of the Arab League for a decade or something like that. The Iranians, on the other hand, the regime figured out that they didn't really need to make any concessions to the United States at all over the past 10 to 15 years, that they could kind of create and enforce a reality in which the U.S. could become its de facto protector against the Israelis. And that's why I think this attack ended up being a huge success for them on April 13th. They were able to prove that when push came to shove, they could launch a sort of simulated nuclear attack on Israel in a way. And the Americans would force the Israelis not to respond. And the Israelis would allow themselves to be forced not to respond.
Let me pull on that particular thread for a second. Why? Why would the Israelis accept that pressure when they've been pretty good historically at accepting some pressure and ignoring other pressure?
The issue has to do with a lot of the details of where Israel gets its weaponry from, right? Israel doesn't have a huge domestic industrial capacity for really much of anything. It's a country that has to import a lot of stuff by sea. It's an island in many sorts of ways. But from the United, what they really need from the United States, though, are kind of these advanced precision munitions that can be, loaded onto an F-35 and then, dropped on the specific floor of an apartment building in Damascus. Right. I mean, there are these unbelievable images from this war of high rise buildings that are still standing with one floor demolished. You can't really do that without the assistance of the United States. The question is how you can kind of game the defense supply chain, right? For instance, in Gaza, despite a lot of reporting on what's actually going on there, Israel really hasn't used their air force all that much, right? Most of the progress that Israel's made in Gaza has been kind of the old fashioned way, right? It's been done with, armored vehicles, bulldozers, guns, things like that, right? The theory being that they're stockpiling their advanced munitions for a potential war in Lebanon, right, where the enemy is a lot more serious and where the challenges are a lot steeper. I would guess that Israel did not retaliate against Iran as much as they could have or arguably should have, because they're kind of saving up their munitions and their diplomatic equities for a war in Lebanon. On the other hand, I have some doubts as to whether such a war will be launched. I think it's somewhat likelier that there's going to be some kind of imperfect diplomatic quote unquote solution that just kind of sets the stage for another war in 10 years. But I think the Israel, much like the Americans, I think the Israelis think that they're being very clever. I was in Israel for 2 weeks back in November and December to work on a profile of Yoav Gallant, who is the current defense minister of Israel. He didn't talk to me, but I had multiple aides of his sort of boast that, he's on the phone with Lloyd Austin every single day. And this is something that his people constantly push out. He talks to Lloyd Austin every day. And the question that popped into my mind is that a good thing? What are those conversations about? What is Lloyd Austin telling him or demanding of him? I think Gallant has kind of handled that relationship extremely well, right? The war is still going on. The U.S. is still supplying Israel with advanced munitions, even if they're slow walking it to a pretty great dramatic degree. But what is the cost of that in the long run? The cost could be that you are taking on strategic constraints that only become apparent in retrospect, right? That only become apparent, you know, on like November 5th, 2024, when you haven't gotten around to invading Lebanon or Rafah yet. And then in time, it seems as if you don't really have much operational freedom at all.
A world under stress like ours needs better leaders in every discipline and in every country. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If you know someone like that in your company, in your university, in your community, anywhere, please nominate her or him for the Tilburg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize. Nominations will open on March 15th. For more info, check out tilburgprize.org. For our audience, we'll provide a link to that profile you did of Gallant, which I think ought to be a must read. It was really quite well done. Let's shift to domestic Israeli politics. Prior to October 7th, Israel seemed to be coming apart at the seams. All of the fighting over the judicial system, over the courts, over settlements, over Bibi himself, and all of it disappeared with the shock of the attack on the 7th. A war cabinet was formed, political issues put aside, partisanship dissolved. The comparison has been made to 9/11, but I think it's 9/11 on steroids in the sense that this was a shock, clearly a shock to Israeli society. What's the consequence of that, do you think, in the medium term?
It's hard to say. So I've been there a couple times since October 7th, and two things stick out at me. Number one is just the kind of cohesion and energy and sense of purpose of the Israeli people. The whole idea of terrorism is to terrorize people. I think the long-term strategy of Hamas and Hezbollah is to create such constant violence that people voluntarily emigrate from Israel. The opposite happened after October 7th. People came back. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis came back. A lot of them stayed. By the way, they came back from all over the world, every corner of the earth. You know, people got their call up, you know, their reserve notices, and they came back. And that's kind of how it's felt there the past couple times I've been. You know, everybody knows someone who is serving in Gaza. Absolutely everyone in Israeli society did something in response to the attacks, whether it was volunteering, whether it was, things came together there in a way that I think is almost impossible in any other kind of Western society at this point. Like, they really showed that they actually cared about defending their country and that some things were beyond politics and not be negotiated. Really remarkable. However, it's not that hard to see a certain kind of nervous condition, you know, the onset of a certain kind of nervous condition in a way, where Israelis don't entirely know how to understand what's just happened to them. And my favorite kind of example of this is that if you go to Sderot, to the former site of the police station, right? So in Sderot, a number of Hamas fighters took over the police station. The army had to call in a tank, which fired on the police station. It was the first time ever that an Israeli tank had fired on an Israeli building inside of Israel, right? So if you go to the former site of that battle, there's now a huge mural of the tank firing on the police station with an unfurled Torah scroll over the police station because it was Simchat Torah, right? It was a major Jewish holiday that day. And to me, this communicates a total emotional incoherence. And it turned out a couple of days after I visited Sderot that some of the ruins of the police station were discovered in like a nature preserve, right? They had, including like certificates given to like, you know, one of the commanding officers of the station who was killed on October 7th, which is completely bizarre as well. So, you know, Israelis carry around this kind of pain that they can't really, that they don't really entirely understand yet, which is itself completely understandable. It's going to take years to sort of figure out exactly how this has penetrated at this point, the way that that pain manifests itself is on the one hand, through great social cohesion, a real sense that this is a winnable fight that's worth it, a real sense that they don't need the world on their side, that they can solve their problems on their own. But you dig a little deeper and there's kind of this reservoir of irresolvable feeling that could lead in all kinds of different directions in the next few years. And that already manifests as something very, very strange.
Oh, it's a classic national case of PTSD. I really do think that's the right framework to think about it. And that can, that does, PTSD does evolve differently for different, in different circumstances.
It's possible to overstate it though. If there is an element of PTSD, it's not the paralyzing type of PTSD. People are very motivated there to do something. It's part of the national psyche. And I think what happened was so horrific that there's a sense across all of society that the group that did this can't be allowed to survive, that it's worth taking on great sacrifices to destroy it. Right. I had someone who's kind of in and out of government tell me the first time I was there back in November that, like, well, if they're going to take us to The Hague, at least it'll be worth it. You know, that I think that is, that's an attitude that still exists, that cuts across political boundaries.
A flip side of all that, though, is what's happening on American campuses, in a lot of newspapers, in Europe, in various places. And you described it, I think, brilliantly, quote, "An act of spectacular violence has vaulted Hamas to respectability and reframed the conflict around their hardline grievances." For some people, I'm not saying objectively that happened, but you're saying for many people, clearly many college kids in the United States, talk about unexpected consequences.
This will be an interesting question for history, right? Much as people now ask, was 9/11 a success for Al-Qaeda? Right. People will ask and can ask whether October 7th was a success for Hamas. And Seth Frantzman, who's the Jerusalem Post's kind of one of their military correspondents, and I think he's their opinion editor, has made this point repeatedly since October 7th that Hamas's objective diplomatic status has improved since then. The Qataris did not kick them out. Right. The Turks are more pro Hamas than they have ever been. Hamas is treated with sort of the prestige of a nation state. And by the way, the United States government is not immune from this either. The U.S. has accepted a number of the negotiating premises of Hamas, right? The whole, I think, rather disturbing idea that Israeli civilians under the age of 50 should be treated as soldiers in the hostage negotiations. That's not exactly a premise that the United States has pushed against very hard. It's been the starting point of every round of hostage negotiations. The pattern of these negotiations has been for Israel to make a fairly generous offer, for Hamas to turn it down, for the U.S. to blame Hamas, and then turn around and pressure Israel into giving Hamas a better deal. And again, this is a group whose only leverage on the battlefield is the hostages, right? Israel could go into Rafah and probably dismantle the rest of their, you know, standing army in a couple of weeks, and it wouldn't be that hard for them to do it. But Hamas is politically protected in a way that, you know, look, I don't think it's, as I said earlier, I don't think it's likely that Israel is going to facilitate a rebuilding of the Gaza Strip that involves handing money to the Hamas government there, right? In that sense, they've lost a certain amount of prestige. On the other hand, they have the U.S. kind of doing their dirty work for them, whether that's what the Biden administration intends or not. They have managed to create kind of diplomatic facts that are very much in their favor, despite October 7th and despite losing on the battlefield. It's a remarkable kind of reversal. And it's one that I think sets a very, very dangerous precedent for conflicts around the world. That if you're just recalcitrant enough, if you're just violent enough, and if you manage to wheedle your way into the Western security architecture the way that Hamas has, you know, through its alliances with Turkey and Qatar, you can be rewarded for it no matter what you do.
The obvious last question, and it's last only because we are running out of time. I could go on for hours with you. The obvious last question is the so-called two-state solution. It's back in vogue. It's popular in Washington, New York, Paris, Berlin, Riyadh. You have pointed out in some of your writing, a quote, "The two-state solution is the American point of view. It is not the Israeli point of view." But it's very much, as I said, in vogue, and there is clearly an enormous push coming out of Washington and elsewhere to somehow force Israel, which doesn't seem interested, and the Palestinians, who certainly aren't interested either, in that old-time religion of the two-state solution. How do you think about it?
So that was actually a quote from Gershon HaCohen, who was the former head of the IDF Staff College and kind of the senior most of sort of the community of right-wing dissident generals in Israel right now. And he's right. He's right. The two-state solution was remains a very kind of American idea, and a very specific kind of American idea, right? It was born out of the Western victory of the Cold War, right? It's the idea that this is a unipolar world where things that seemed impossible were possible now, and that the kind of inherent morality of American global leadership could bring about these massive shifts that people previously thought could never, ever happen, right? Which is to say that belief in the two-state solution is really a belief in ourselves as Americans, which is why the idea has penetrated so deeply, why it's kind of one of the, right? It's part of the catechism of the American elite in a way, that we can make peace here. Reality, particularly in the Middle East, has a way of kind of complicating our own view of ourselves and our own kind of centrality to human affairs. I don't really see things getting any simpler or any clearer on that count in the next few decades. I kind of think of the two-state solution this way. You know, there are various kind of elements to state-level sovereignty, right? Control of borders, control of airspace, monopoly on violence within your own borders, you know, representation at the UN. You just kind of go down the list. And you have to ask, for this particular polity, is it a good idea to give them any of these things, all of these things, some of these things? You know, one of the issues that I really cared about 15 years ago was South Sudan. I went there twice in 2012, right after independence, and in 2014. I had kind of bought into the line that what the North Sudanese had done to the South was so horrific that the only sort of solution would be independence for, you know, below the Nuba Mountains, basically, for those communities that had been oppressed for so long. And they had been oppressed. And what, you know, the North Sudanese did to the South was abhorrent, you know, one of the worst crimes of the post-war era, certainly. But you look at what independence has actually looked like for the last 11 or 12 years. And any kind of intellectually honest observer has to ask whether, again, giving these powers and responsibilities of statehood to that particular group of people at that particular time actually made things any better or any more just, for that matter, right? South Sudan has been in a state of, you know, quasi-civil war for a decade, much of it along kind of ethnic and tribal lines. Is that good? Is that just? Is that better than sort of an arrangement in which, you know, there was either a kind of confederation or some kind of, you know, novel idea of sovereignty that could have resolved sort of the bigger issues while leaving some kind of pre-existing state structure intact? Unfortunately, the entire kind of like post-war, you know, liberal global order doesn't think in those terms, right? Sovereignty is thought of as sort of an all or nothing proposition. And I think there are many cases around the world where perhaps more creative thinking is needed. And this might very well be one of them.
I think it clearly is one of them. Armin Rosen, thank you for this conversation. I really have put you on my list. I've got to keep on checking. Whenever you write something, I've got to read it. I think, biases aside, backgrounds aside, we really do need some innovative thinking here. And I think you bring that to your reporting.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. I appreciate anyone reading me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.